Hello and welcome to Lexitecture, a podcast about word origins and histories. My name is Ryan, and in each episode, my friend Amy and I bring a new pair of words to share their stories with each other and you. You can find our past episodes and the occasional blog post on our website at lexitecture.com. Follow along with us on Twitter and Facebook at Lexitecture. And if you really like what we do, you can support the show at patreon.com/lexitecture. Today's episode, Gay Blood.
Before we jump in with words, we have new Patreon people. Hooray!
Hey!
So, whoop, whoop. Two new Patreon sponsors this time around. So, Christy Filipich and Anne Young.
Hey, Christy!
So, thank you very, very much.
Anne Young in the house.
To Christy and Anne. Yeah, it's great. They're awesome. All our Patreon sponsors are awesome.
They really got
access to our Talk the Talk crossover episode, which was
a lot of fun.
And hopefully people are enjoying that. If you want to join Christy and Anne and all the other awesome people, patreon.com/lexitecture. Advertising over. Thank you very much, patrons. You guys are awesome.
I don't know. Maybe you'll immediately edit this out because you think it's a terrible idea, but might it be a plan to ask our patrons what would they like to see in patron-only content?
Yeah, that's what I sort of put up a couple of posts just kind of saying, if you have ideas, let me know. A couple of people just said,
yeah, sure.
Sounds good. We'll keep you posted. Some people said the bonus content is nice, but we're basically just, as long as you keep doing the show, that's what we're in it for, which is very nice.
Cool. Very
so,
nice.
Yeah, I guess our going forward approach is, we will do what we feel is cool and awesome, and we're just going to keep going until you guys tell us to stop.
Until someone tells us. Yeah.
Yeah.
Like
that's sort of how we go. That's kind of how I feel like we go anyway, just in general.
Yeah, that's sort of our jam.
Yeah. I believe I went first last time, and you said you were super excited about your word, so I am vicariously excited, so.
I am super excited about my word. I'll tell you why. Okay.
Okay.
Well, so one of the reasons why I'm really excited about this word is, for once, I have not been a crazy hot mess in terms of my research and planning.
Okay.
Just for once.
Yeah.
I think that's maybe one time that's happened.
Once in a row.
So, once in a row. So, you know, if you listen, we've talked about this before. We're quite fast and loose with the old research. That doesn't mean that we don't care about what we do. We absolutely do. But, you know, I have 4.5 jobs. And sometimes, a lot of my research happens at night in bed when my husband is already asleep and I shouldn't really be on my phone because when am I ever going to get to sleep? That's a good kind of time slot for me to start to think about what words am I going to talk about and do a little bit of digging and see what's interesting and what's not. I saw a meme about that this week, which was something along the lines of, why can't I get to sleep? He thought to himself while shining a beam of pure information into his face from 8 to 10 inches away. And I'm like, yeah, that is pretty much my life.
This damn insomnia.
Bedtime lights out. I wonder why they wear that colour in that film. Let's ask the Google.
Just hook human knowledge straight to my brain.
I have a lot of questions. Just, you know, generally.
Right.
I have a lot of questions. So this week I have not done that. In fact, my research has been so detailed for this word that I couldn't just rely on looking at the excellent source material that I usually look at and then flying by the seat of my pants. I have been defeated by this word. I had to compile quite thorough notes because, my goodness, it's a big one, right?
Neat.
And if you feel that you have to cut me off because I'm going on too long about this word, I absolutely understand.
Okay.
That would be appropriate because I have a lot of things to say about the word blood.
Oh.
B-L-O-O-D.
Neat.
And blood, I mean, blood is neat. Not for everybody. Some people get really, really squeamish about it. I understand that.
Yeah.
It is an old, 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 old word. So Etym Online gives it as coming from Old English blod, B-L-O-D, with only one O.
Okay.
Fluid which circulates in the arteries and veins. From Proto-Germanic, Blodam, B-L-O-D-A-M, which is blood. And the meaning, in some senses, the meaning of this word has stayed really, really constant because it applies to a concrete, viewable, touchable thing. So, you know, you can imagine blood is blood is blood. And as long as there have been humans, we have had blood. So the sense of the red stuff that comes out of us when you hit me with something sharp, that sense is as old as the word is.
Right.
Etymonline goes on to say that the etymology is a little bit, it's a little bit unclear. So some sources will say that it comes from Proto-Indo-European root, which ultimately stems from the Proto-Indo-European root bel, that's B-H-E-L.
Okay.
Which is a pie root that we've talked about before. I couldn't remember where. I was looking back through all the episodes to figure out where it was, but I couldn't find it. So bel has got three different senses. We have first to shine, flash, or to burn, and that it gives us words like blanch, flame, fulminate, effulgence, which is a lovely word, flammable. Mm-hmm. We then have bel number two, to blow or to swell, which gives us words like balloon and ball and bollocks and phallus.
Okay.
And we also have the third, which is a Proto-Indo-European root meaning to thrive or to bloom, possibly a variant of pie root bel, to blow or to swell.
Hmm.
And so from this we get the sense of flowering or blooming. But we also have possibly pie root blow, B-H-L-O, perhaps meaning to swell, to gush, or to spurt, or that which bursts out. So we have in Gothic, bloth, blood, and bloma, flower. So we don't have any certain etymology of the word. And some linguists, some assume that because there is no clear root into Indo-European and into Proto-Indo-European, that it, in fact it has a non-Indo-European origin. Now, Etymonline has this to say, which I think very, very interesting. There seems to have been an avoidance in Germanic, perhaps from taboo, of other pie words for blood, such as esen, source of poetic Greek ear, Old Latin aser, Sanskrit arsk, and Hittite Eshar, also Kru, which seems to have had a sense of blood outside the body or gore from a wound, which is the source of Latin cruor, blood from a wound, and Greek kreas, meat. Hmm. It came to mean simply blood in the Balto-Slavic group and some other languages. I like this idea that blood was a taboo subject, something that couldn't be talked about and shouldn't be talked about.
Yeah.
And I think that, you know, it makes sense. In the days when people were using Proto-Indo-European, assuming that Proto-Indo-European really ever existed at all, not a whole lot of healthcare kicking around.
Not much, and I wouldn't think.
Blood outside the body, definitely not a good thing to be happening.
Yeah.
So, you know, it's not hard to imagine that blood might have had a sense of that taboo. And, you know, as I talked about, sometimes people are squeamish about blood. They don't even like to hear it talked about. Apologies if you're one of those people. This is going to be a long episode for
you.
Yeah,
buckle up.
Okay, buckle up. So Etymonline then goes on to talk about inheritance and relationship senses, which are also found in other languages like Latin and Greek. And these emerged by the mid-13th century in English. And we also have the fluid of life, the presumed seat of the passions. Blood has stood for temper of mind or natural disposition since about 1300 and has been given many figurative extensions. Yes, wow. Yes, yeah. It has.
Yeah.
Slang meaning hot spark or a man of fire. This is from Johnson. This is from the 1560s. Blood pressure attested from 1862. Blood money from 1530s. Originally money paid for causing the death of another. Now, Etymonline goes on to talk about some other expressions and phrases that we have regarding blood. It also mentions just vaguely the verb to blood, as in to smear or to stain something with blood. There is so much to talk about with regards to the noun blood. I don't think I'm even going to get to the verb today.
Okay.
So, OED. I am so damn grateful for the OED this week.
Yeah.
Oh, such a literally a fountain of knowledge, a fountain of blood knowledge. And we have, well, In the etymology section, we have lots and lots of examples of other Germanic languages that have this blod, bluot, blut, pluot, all these very, very similar variations upon the theme of the various ways that this word has been used. I'm wondering right now, should I just read the etymology entry from the OED? I think I'm gonna.
Okay.
So, we have here, cognate with Old Frisian, blod, meaning blood, blood relationship, lineage, blood relative. Old Dutch, bloot, meaning blood, complexion, kin, family, blood relative. Dutch, bloed, blood, bloodshed, disposition or temper, kin, race, lineage, kinship. Old Saxon, blod, blood as one of the humours. Middle Low German, blot, blood, of plants, as in sap. Bloodshed, blood relative, living being, person, rascal. Now, I'm only about three or four lines into the etymology, and there's quite a lot more. But
yeah.
One of the things that I find really, really fascinating about this word is this word has always had a lot of meanings. For as long as we're aware of it, it doesn't just mean the red stuff.
Mm.
Which is really, really cool. Obviously, the red stuff is important. It's biologically important to us, and you know, as we'll see through some of the other, through some of the other usages, it covers a lot of ground. But it's been covering a lot of ground for as long as we have a record of it in English. So I started to count in the OED. I started to count the number of entries that contain the word blood, either as a compound word or as a phrase, and there are more than 100.
Wow.
Quite a lot more than 100. And then, you know, so underneath, I'm looking at the entry here on OED Online, and it gives you the word and its pronunciations, forms, etymology, la, la, la. And then it goes into the various different meanings. So I scrolled, and I scrolled, and I read, and I scrolled, and I read, and I scrolled, and I read, and I scrolled. And at this point, I started to think, Amy, there will be no keeping this stuff in your head and then talking to Ryan about it today. No, that's not right. Going to work. Afraid not.
Right.
So what I did was I made some proper notes. Hooray!
Oh, wow.
Finally, I made some nice. Proper notes. Yeah. And here's what I discovered. Here's what I got interested in. This is an old word. It's one of these words that's onomatopoeic, but not obviously so.
Okay.
Blood, 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 blood. And it feels like it feels like the word blurt, you know, that sort of blur, blur, blur,
yeah, yeah.
Noise. The noise of wine coming out of a wine bottle that has
it's a great noise.
That same kind of pulsing, flowing affair.
Yeah.
And I also as part of the sort of organizing of the data that I've done in these notes, I realized that I regularly look at these terms in the OED and I have no idea what they mean. So because it is such an old word, I had to find out what does the OED mean when it says early Old English versus Old English versus late Old English.
Right.
Thankfully, the OED tells you everything,
yeah.
Always in the world. It's so great. I love it.
It's handy.
And early Old English is from 600 to 950 AD.
Okay. Wow. Yeah.
Old English, they take to mean 950 to 1100, and late Old English from 1100 to 1150. And although that wasn't always the case, 1150 is the period during which the language that we know as Old English is said to have stopped. You know, that's the kind of line that they've drawn underneath it.
Right.
At one point it was 1250. 1225, I forget which one, but it's now, as subsequent editions of the dictionary, it's been kind of standardised. So
just long so enough after the Norman invasion that it really got supplanted.
Yeah, I suppose that's probably the rationale for drawing the line in that place.
Right.
And even in early Old English, now we've talked very, very, very many times about how the first written citation isn't necessarily the first time that the word was used,
right.
Of course. And when you're looking at early Old English texts, you know, your choices are fairly limited.
Yeah.
Because time destroys books.
Yeah.
And and books have not always been preserved as well as they currently are. So, you know, it's the whole National Treasure, Scrolls from the Library of Alexandria type
yeah.
affair.
Yeah, exactly.
You know, you know well that I hate Nicolas Cage, but I freaking love those films.
Everyone's got one. Everyone says they hate Nicolas Cage. They've always got
well,
one.
Well, National Treasure 1 and 2.
Here you go.
I just love the ridiculous, silly Indiana Jones romp of National Treasure. I love their, we don't give a damn about actual history. Let's just make it fun approach. And yeah, good fun films.
Absolutely.
I also recently watched the episode. I don't know if you're up to date with Brooklyn Nine-Nine or not.
Yeah.
But the episode with Jake and Kevin and the Nicolas Cage DVDs.
Yes. It's all so good.
So there's one about a mandolin and you kept it from me.
Did I told you about my one-time project that I'm still got on the back burner that I might revive again. I had a project for a year I was calling Caged for a Year, where I set down a challenge to myself to watch every single Nicolas Cage movie ever made in the span of one calendar year and blog about it each time.
I remember this. Yeah. I think this might have been the source for the great, what? When I said, I hate Nicolas Cage.
Yeah. I'm going to bring it back. One of these years, I'm going to do an actual proper Caged for a Year. I'm going to go all the way through. Captain Crowley's mandolin was actually pretty good.
What you need is to be in witness protection.
See, if I was in, I just have to witness something terrible, and then I will finally finish my watch all of Nicolas Cage's filmography in a calendar year project.
Perfect.
It's also simple.
So, Nicolas Cage aside.
Right, yeah.
Genuinely can't remember why I started to talk about Nicolas Cage and National Treasure. Oh, yeah, Scrolls from the Library of Alexandria. You know, so we can assume that there was a lot more written material in the early Old English period than we have access to, modern access to. That being said, even though there are all these limitations to our knowledge about early Old English, in the early Old English period, blood still had three different meanings.
Wow.
So, it was the red fluid in the arteries and veins.
Right.
It was also your mental or emotional disposition, your temperament.
Okay.
And the sense of letting blood existed in the early Old English period too. So using leeches or bleeding, or, you know, therapeutic, getting rid of some extra blood, because who needs that stuff?
No, obviously.
And then we move on to 950 to 1100. She says as if it's not an absolutely incredible period of time to talk about.
Yeah. Oh, that old chestnut.
There are a further eight senses for the word blood.
Good grief.
In the Old English period that we have access to.
Yeah, let alone the ones that are forgotten.
We start to get into the sense of blood that's been shed, or blood that's going to be shed, or violence or murder, the fact of being killed, that sort of thing. Right. We then get, you know, sort of pretty straightforward comparative meanings. So a liquid that resembles blood in colour being called blood.
Okay.
We also have responsibility for guilt or for bloodshed, which is still kind of used mainly in the sense of having blood on your hands.
Blood on your hands, yeah.
That dates from Old English.
Wow.
We then get, of course, the sense of bloodshed and sacrifice, particularly Christ's sacrifice. And reference to the blood of Christ in terms of, you know, the sacraments and consecration, all that kind of thing.
Right, yeah.
We then get the sense of blood. Now, this one I like because, you know, we know that there's red stuff in there. And if you take something sharp to a person, you'll see that red stuff on the outside rather than the inside. But in Old English, they were aware that this was the fluid that sustains life. So the idea of lifeblood, or the vital principle, that thing that your life depends on, starts to be discussed, starts to be used in that sense too. And also, way back in the Old English period, the notion of birth, lineage, heredity, blood that connects you to a person or your
bloodline,
your
that
ancestors.
Type of,
yeah, exactly. Specifically, that sense of you know, the comparison, blood of the grape, referring to wine or grape juice.
Oh, okay.
And, you know, by this time, I couldn't find any specific late Old English citations for words pertaining to blood or meanings of blood. So by this time, we've gotten ourselves to about 1225. Okay?
Okay.
A further two senses of the word emerge within the century. So we have to let blood in the non-therapeutic sense, you know, to cause someone to bleed, to kill them. And in 1275, this is amazing. In 1275, bloodstream. That is when the word bloodstream was first being used, being written down. So yeah, considering in those days no one had any sense of etymology and anatomy and sorry, not etymology, of anatomy, and certainly dissections weren't happening as far as we're aware in any sort of sense of inquiry, but yeah. The idea of a bloodstream was there.
I wonder if that's the earliest or what the earliest medical, anatomical, scientific referring to the body or vivisections or life or anything else, like the terms that we still use now, I wonder what the earliest one and if that's the earliest one.
Ryan, please. I have work to do and sleep to have and a life to live. You can't go dropping projects like that onto me. You know, if I ever go to prison, then you can suggest things like that to me.
Correction?
Because I'll have time.
Correction.
Okay.
You had things to do and people to see and places to go. You now have one mission.
Yeah, that is a seriously interesting question. I like it a lot. So we're only at 300. Sorry, we're only at 1300.
Jeez.
And in the next 100 years, we are going to see another 8 senses, another 8 meanings of the word blood. From 1300, blood as in one's family.
Mm-hmm.
From about 1325, the wonderful, wonderful, and I know you'll like this, in oaths and asseverations, chiefly with direct or euphemistic reference to the blood of Christ. God's blood!
Neat.
That sort of affair.
Yeah.
From the same sort of time, around about 1325, we have inherited characteristics, so blood as the sort of vehicle of heredity, and distinguishing members of a common family or a nation or a breed from other groups. People who belong to those particular lineages. So, you know, we see a lot of these words are pretty, they're well related to each other. You wouldn't call them completely new meanings, but they are new usages.
Right.
We then go on to, from 1387, very early, this sense of being of aristocratic birth or a good family, a good parentage.
Oh, okay, yeah.
More on that in a minute. That's, yeah, you sound a little disappointed, and there's a good reason to be disappointed. Like so many words that have been around for very many centuries, blood is kind of racist.
Yeah.
And by kind of racist, I mean super, super racist.
Yeah.
So we then get passion, ardour, spirit, which seems to kind of split into two camps. We either have that sense of passion in terms of anger or rage, you know, high emotions, or we have a slightly more positive boldness, fighting spirit, courage. And along with that comes the opposite. So you might describe someone as being bloodless, who lacks those qualities.
Oh, okay.
We then also in, oh, my date order is all messed up in this century. We have a person with, it says here, a person with distinguishing word. In other words, a person, a living being, you could refer to as a blood. And then again, the blood of Christ. So we're only on 1400.
Wow.
And in the 1400s, we get another 6 senses of the word blood.
Jeez.
Like, blood is a good agent.
It's the gift that keeps on giving.
So in around about 1400, we get blood spilling. This one made me laugh quite a lot. Oh, no, sorry, not blood spilling. I'm shooting my guns too early. I'll reel back a little bit. So we have blood spilling. My favourite 1400s usage of blood, given in the OED, is this phrase here, to the blood, which is defined as to the point where blood flows, or figuratively to an extreme or painful degree, like to the quick. But what this made me think of, as I believe it should make any right-thinking person, is, go for it.
The Princess Bride?
Yay, exactly.
To the pain?
Not to the death, to the pain. And yeah, if you're not aware of that scene, and if you're not aware of that film, sort out your life.
Yeah.
Quite simply, sort out your life.
Go watch
Go to prison, watch that film.
It's not a prison stuff today.
I don't know what that's about. So To the Blood was being used around about 1400s. We then have the sense of a blood relative, and proverbial phrases that indicate that bloodshed causes more bloodshed. So things like blood will have blood or blood requires blood.
Right.
Emerging as early as that. The physical nature of man, animal passions or base or fleshly appetites. And this interesting phrase, proximity of blood. So the fact or condition of being near or close in relation. So sort of like kinship or nature, closeness. You and I are of, you know, we have proximal blood, if you like.
Right.
So this takes us all the way to 1450. That's right. We're only at 1450. And the next 100 years will give us another 11 definitions for the word blood.
Great.
You can see now why I made some notes.
Yeah, no kidding.
So we start in roughly 1523, a disease of sheep characterized by sudden collapse and usually death. Who doesn't love a sheep disease?
We then have
1535. Yeah, sheep are not fans. A stranger in blood, so someone who isn't related to you, or someone who isn't your friend. 1567, blood spitting through disease, you know, or illness. And then 1567 also, this phrase, second in blood, or second of kin, which exists in Scots law from that period. And someone who's second in blood is, quote, one related in the second degree of consanguinity. So in other words, your first cousin is second in blood.
Right.
And I believe that this term refers to, you know, inheritance, basically. 1573 brings us the wonderful Bloodcraft, which means a murderous conspiracy. And frankly, if there isn't a metal band out there called Bloodcraft, what is happening to the universe?
Yeah, it's all wrong.
And then from 1575, such a fascinating, you know, I almost had the sense as I put these in date order of, you know, it made me think of Kevin Stroud, History of English podcast. You really do get a sense of what must have been going on in the world for these different usages to be coming up. I then thought, I wonder if Kevin has an episode on blood, and he does. So it's called Flesh and Blood. I believe it's a fairly recent episode. As always, you know, we always recommend Kevin's podcast. It's just fantastic.
And it's actually the second time in the last 30 seconds that I thought of it too, because as you were saying, and in 1450, that's right, we're only up to 1450. I kept thinking about how he had planned his podcast for like a 1 or 2 year run, and then 6 years later, he's almost at Chaucer. So yeah.
Yeah, I love that so much. It's great. Yeah, so we then get the sense of to be in blood. Now, this was originally a term applied to falcons and then later on to hens. And it's this idea of having been given an initial taste of the blood of the prey that someone wants you
right,
to hunt.
Okay.
Or training an animal to hunt. Yeah, getting the scent, that same sort of thing. And you can also then have the figurative sense of being out of blood. So out of hunting condition or not having a taste for blood.
Right.
1576 gives us to have one's blood up. In other words, to be in a state of rage or in the mood for a fight. And 1593 gives us make the blood run cold. I love that, you know, it makes me think of sort of schlocky horror films, but that's it's schlocky horror film type stuff has been around since 1593. 1594, this really made me giggle. So 1594, we have the citation of blood drinking.
Okay.
But it's not until 1630 that we get blood drinker. And I love the notion that people were just sitting around for 36 years going, so we know that blood drinking is happening, but what can we call the people who are doing it?
What are we going to call these people?
Who are these people? What do they, you know, what makes them tick?
Yeah, that's right.
So we then get in also 1594 to call for a person's blood. In other words, to demand that they be killed or to seek revenge upon a person.
Right.
And in 1599, a family descended from a common ancestor. So we've made it all the way to the 1600s, and there's plenty more to come. We got another 13 definitions in the 1600s. Hold on, I can't count. Another 8 in the 1700s. When we get into the 1800s, things really, really sort of ramp up. And we have 26 new senses of the word blood between 1811 and 1893. We then have a further 16 in the 1900s. I couldn't find any in the 2000s. So, you know, I would absolutely go through them all, but this is what I mean. This isn't an exhaustive list. There were more definitions in the OED entry for blood, but there were just too many to realistically deal with in a single episode. So a couple of things that sort of stood out to me as we go on from the 1700s. There's a very marked sense that from 1711 onwards, as we're looking at this list, that people start to get a lot more interested in lineage and pedigree,
right?
In this time period. So we have some that don't refer to this. We have, for example, the use of the word to mean a rowdy or a foppish young man, a rake or a dandy. Who doesn't love a dandy? And it says here it's rare and archaic in later use, except in the phrase young blood, which, you know, we might still use today.
Right, yeah.
But we have lots of terms of lineage and pedigree and being of good stock, inherited characteristics, having pride in one's nationality or race. And, you know, these things existed to an extent in the early Old English period, but this was not the focus of the word, most definitely not. We then have things like the delightfully terrifying, from 1791, blood knot, a multiple overhand knot of a kind formerly tied at the end of whips to increase the pain of the blows inflicted. Charming. And as we go on into the 1800s and onwards, things start to get really racist, basically.
Right, of course.
So, yeah. So we have this little nugget of how terrible the universe is. 1675, pure blood, defined by the OED as a person of unmixed origin, defined as of unmixed origin, ancestry or descent, also in extended use. So at this point, pure blood means unmixed origin, unmixed origin, ancestry or descent.
Right.
However, the second sense given of the word pure blood from 1842, that's right, 1842, mm-hmm. all the way from 1675, at which point that term began to be used for animals rather than people.
Oh.
So what I kind of got interested in is the sense of when did blood become a weapon to be used against people, if you like. So right. We have blue blood from 1811, which is believed to come from the notion that people with white skin are able to see the blue veins at their wrists.
You can
see the blood vessels, whereas someone with darker skin, it's not so easy to see that particular feature. 1817 gives us mixed blood. 1818, when I saw this, I was like, oh, what a horrible, awful term. And of course, it's Scottish. Gutter blood, a base-born or low-bred person, one of the rabble. Sir Walter Scott uses it. We get you know, lots of fairly benign things. Blood coral, a type of coral. Blood vein, a type of moth. The notion of tasting blood, so an experience that stimulates further efforts to sort of recapture that initial success.
Right.
Or to be out for blood. We have, in 1844, blood Indians, as in the name that was given to a particular group or tribe of Indians. So you have citations in that group saying things like, you know, the Bloods and the Blackfeet and the Sioux did such
right,
and such.
Okay.
1856 gives us to smell blood, which is quite late. I would have thought that would have been an older one. And in around 1862, we get mixed blood, referring to a person of such descent.
Right.
That actually comes from Ralph Waldo Emerson, who was discussed in the Seeing White podcast,
mm-hmm.
which was interesting. Let's leave it with that.
Yeah.
We have things like blood tingling, blood groove, a groove cut in the head or shaft of an arrow or spear to increase the amount of blood drawn by the weapon.
Jeez.
Only from 1873. That was an interesting one too. I feel as though these things have probably existed for a very long time before that, but in 1873 people started writing about them. Interestingly, blood transfusions date from 1866, or at least the phrase does, giving blood or donating blood from 1875. Hmm. And blood sports only come into the lexicon in 1893.
That's surprising.
Yeah, very much so. In 1911, we get blood type and blood results. Blood results in 1910, excuse me. And then also in 1911, we get this very interesting, quite horrendous phrase, blood libel, I'd never heard of this, but
no.
Blood libel refers to the completely unfounded defamatory accusation that Jewish people used the blood of Christians in their religious rituals, especially in making Passover bread.
Ace.
So, yeah, you know, if you want to really strike at the root of a strongly held emotion, use blood. That seems to be what we see from this.
It seems to be the lesson.
Only in 1919 do we find the phrase to be out for a person's blood, in other words, to seek revenge upon someone. And then 1919 gives us blood typing and blood grouping. I really enjoyed this one. In 1922, we have the first written citation of the blood wagon, which is an ambulance.
Oh,
followed later in 1942 by the Bloodmobile, which was a mobile blood donation centre. Yeah, Bloodmobile is pretty great. Presumably that came around in response to the 1940 term, blood drive, as in,
Right, yeah, the campaign to get people
soldiers
to donate
are bleeding
blood.
Quite a lot. We need this stuff.
Yeah.
Then we come a little bit later to 1965, where we have the African-American usage of a person, a black person, occasionally used in terms of like a group of or all of the black people, but like a form of address, a close male friend.
Oh,
like
okay.
The sort of words you would use instead of brother.
Right,
my
yeah.
Bloods, going out with my bloods.
Okay.
1971, depressingly, gives us blood doping. And hot on its heels, we have blood packing, which is the same thing, just a different term from the sense of giving yourself a blood transfusion in order to improve your performance. 1983 gives us a new blood post. This is a chiefly British usage. It refers to an academic post at a new university, typically for new, younger staff in response to a shortage of staff or a, you know, a restructuring.
Right.
And then lastly, in 1999, we have the phrase blood diamond, referring to diamonds that are mined under unethical and often illegal and certainly immoral conditions.
Thank you, Leonardo DiCaprio and a terrible South African accent.
Leonardo DiCaprio and a terrible South African accent. I couldn't find any from 2000 onwards, but you know, I feel as though there's more. Because what blood seems to do is it seems to flow. It flows out into almost every facet of our society, of our humanity. And I find it super duper interesting that this stuff that is supposed to stay inside has, you know, it almost provides a cultural societal history just by looking at the way that, that this word has been brought into service in so many different causes and so many different meanings.
Yeah. It's interesting that
blood.
It's cool because it's obviously biologically so foundational that it makes sense that it would become a touchstone for people who just want to find a word for things or an expression.
Yeah, sure.
It's just sort of always there. The blood sport thing was interesting to me that it happened so late because my first thought was, well, blood sports have been around for as long as people have been around because people just like hurting people for sport and entertainment, and that's just how it's always been done.
Yeah, sure.
But then it occurred to me that maybe in the middle 1800s, like maybe blood sports became differentiated because that was the first time that there were sports that weren't blood sports. And so they needed to find a word for what had always just been called sport. Because there was
things
like bear baiting and gladiatorial combat and dueling and all these other things. And it's like all of a sudden there's tennis. And so now we need to find a word for duels and gladiators now that there's like badminton around. And they're calling themselves sports, and we have to, you know.
I'm absolutely imagining someone from the 1100s watching a game of tennis and going, well, it's good, but where's the blood?
Yeah, when do they start stabbing each other with the... Those are sheaths, right? They take
up
the handle, and they're going to stab each other with the rackets. Is that how this... I want my money back. I'm going home. Wow.
How much? The strawberries are how much?
That's, wow. Amazing.
Yeah.
That's blood. A... Long and bloody history.
Long and bloody history. And, you know, like, I'm absolutely cherry picking both out of the OED entry and cherry picking out of the notes that I've made because there's just so many cool words and phrases that have that have come about. I might
Very
just
nice.
Keep randomly, like, throwing them into things.
Yeah, just tossing them in. It's a liberal sprinkling as it goes along. Very cool.
That was entirely blood tingling. Yeah, cool.
So... My word today, I don't know if it's... Anyway, we just finished June, which was Pride Month, and so I thought belatedly, I was like, I should do this word. And we were going to be recording in June, and then we decided not to. We put it back a week. But as a couple of memes that I've seen talk about, how at the end of, like at the end of Black History Month, people kind of go,
I was just thinking about Black History Month.
Now we don't have to worry, but we've done our deed for the year. Sort of the same thing with Pride Month. Pride, like during June, everything is rainbows and butterflies and inclusivity. And then July shows up and it's like, well, good. Now we can go back to real life. So
I feel like I've noted a lot more awareness and publicity and general acceptance of Pride Month this year particularly so, which is great, you know, absolutely. And I've read quite a lot of things online about things like appropriation of Pride and people who are unaware of the sort of bloody struggle and history of Pride and the Stonewall riots and things like that. And it's interesting to now see, you know, like Sainsbury's, which is a large supermarket here in the UK, it's a long established family business, been around since Victorian times, I think. And Sainsbury's, it was when it was in Edinburgh, they had a large prominent notice displayed outside saying, we support LGBTQ+ customers and patrons. And I was like, oh, that's an odd notice.
Yeah.
I mean, I get it. I understand that they're like, we are doing our bit for Pride Month. We wish to underline the fact that this is the case. But like, honestly, and you know, feel free, listeners, to weigh in with this if you think that I have an absolutely ridiculous point of view on this, because I'm not part of the LGBTQ+ community, and you know, I like to be aware of the fact that there are situations where I talk about things where I'm perhaps not aware of the privileges that I enjoy.
Right.
So please feel free to call me out, but I'd kind of rather see shops putting up notices that say, we do not support people to be humans and love who they want, because then I could avoid those shops, you know? Then
right,
I could say, all right, okay, not going in there. I kind of assume that business owners don't discriminate against people whose sexual preferences
customers,
do not mirror their own. That's sort of my base. And you know, the world is not a beautiful, happy fairyland where that is the case, and I understand that. But yeah, I found that really interesting.
Yeah. Let the bigots post
it was
their
like the whole
not wanted signs, and then you can just know which places not to go and buy your peaches.
Yeah, yeah. It's like the whole Chris Rock routine about saying, people say, I take care of my children.
Yeah.
And he's like, you're supposed to.
You're not supposed to go to jail. Yeah.
I support Pride. Yeah, good.
Yeah,
you
good.
Should.
Yeah. I guess it all goes back to that old things that go without saying sometimes need to be said.
Yeah, you're right.
Too bad.
Sometimes they need to be said. Yeah, fair enough. Anyway, continue.
So my word this time is gay.
Oh, wonderful.
And so the word gay comes basically straight from Anglo-Norman. It showed up, brought in from the French, and shows up in English as early as 1225.
I'm going to have to interrupt you.
Yeah.
Because I'm totally tickled by either gay blood or blood gay.
Yeah.
Exactly. This episode's title is going to be interesting either way.
I'm trying to think of which way to do it, but by the end of it, I'll come up with something.
My apologies.
So the mid-1300s is where it sort of really gets going. Ultimate origin is unknown. Edom Online posits that it's possibly Frankish, related to the old High German word for pretty. Mm-hmm. But the earliest uses in English, so there's a cluster, and this goes, again, cycles back to the idea that things are in use before they're in written use.
Sure.
So, and especially with something like this, you can tell it's been used for a while because it shows up in writing in a whole bunch of different contexts and meanings and uses. And so it's obvious that these were being used before and it developed into all these different uses. So the earliest English uses are, there was noble or beautiful, which was chiefly sort of a poetic, a conventional poetic epithet for in praise of a woman. You would call her gay because she's noble or beautiful. That's 1325. 1375, bright or lively looking. more generally just good, like to you know the phrase, I have a good mind to do something? It would have been, I have a gay mind to do this thing. Because the gay just meant good, more generally. Finely or showily dressed was sort of 1387. A little bit later in the beginning of the 1400s, you get lighthearted and carefree. There's a very brief window of uses where it's, it takes on sort of a more negative, wanton, lewd, lascivious, which I'm sort of picturing, as in a lot of the cases, most people going lighthearted and carefree, and the people for whom being lighthearted and carefree is bad, they are the ones writing that they are wanton, lewd, and lascivious. So that's...
That makes perfect sense to me, yeah.
It seems to make sense, but I don't have any textual backup and proof of that, but that's my thought. It's also used as an adverb, to be in a gay mood, to be joyously, brightly or showily, or a noun. A gay was a noble or beautiful lady in the early 1400s, and then later on, anything that looks bright or showy was a gay as a noun. And so there's loads of different definitions and uses in English, basically right from the word go. And it makes sense because the Old Middle French, which is where it comes from, has just as many. So here's the OED's rundown of the uses in French just before it arrived as Anglo-Norman in English. So you have of a face happy or cheerful that expresses gaiety, second half of the 11th century, or the 1100s, sorry, amorous, 1160, carefree, frivolous, fickle, 1165, licentious, lascivious, lewd, 1165. So there's that carefree, frivolous in 1165, and then licentious, lascivious, and lewd, also 1165. So there's that parallel
thing.
Because
as soon as something is good, people have got to make it about sex.
People who are complaining about it being good, and those people shouldn't be having fun, and therefore they're lewd and lascivious. Yeah.
Exactly.
Interestingly, of an animal's coat, speckled, in 1170, a good-looking human body, about 1220, a spirited or frisky horse, about 1230, this is an interesting one also. Of the color green, bright or yellowish, as in vert gay in 1300, or any color that inspires or creates gaiety, 1382.
That's a beautiful rainbow pride flag type definition.
Yeah, right, exactly, yeah. And so I went to Smith's because it seemed like the kind of thing that he might have gotten into. And I wanted to know...
Oh my God, I'm so excited to see what Smith has to say about gay.
And I wanted to know, because again, one of the reasons I like Synonyms Discriminated is that it shows where people's heads were in sort of the mid to late 1800s as far as... Because that you can tell what people thought of words by what they associated with them with as synonyms.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, sure.
So there's two entries. So I look up in the index for gay and it appears... as a synonym for cheerful, and then as a synonym for gaudy, G-A-U-D-Y. Mm-hmm. So under cheerful, Smith says, quote, gay is a term which denotes less of animal spirits and expresses the brightness which appears outside in the appearance or the aspect of things external. It combines the ideas of cheerfulness and showiness. As cheerfulness is unruffled, mirth tumultuous, sprightliness buoyant, so gaiety is characteristically self-indulgent. The lover of gaiety despises, dislikes, and avoids the responsibilities, duties, and sobrieties of existence and would, if possible, ignore its troubles altogether.
Hooray!
Which is fantastic,
sign
right?
me up!
Yeah, exactly. The duties, sobrieties of existence could be ignored if possible. Like, yeah, who does that not refer to?
That's kind of the reason why I can't be on Twitter very often.
Exactly, because that's where the duties, sobrieties, and... drawbacks of existence live is on Twitter.
They really do.
And under gaudy, as a side note, gaudy, because I immediately looked that up and it's just a little aside. So gaudy comes from the noun a god, G-A-U-D, meaning a trinket or a bauble, something decorative that just kind of
nice.
you ordain something with. So under gaudy, Smith says, quote, gay denotes such coloring as expresses or inspires gladness. Nor is it restricted to coloring, but life, activity, form, festive arrangement, and light equally contribute to a gay scene. A little bit later, the three terms, gaudy, showy, and gay, are applicable to inanimate substances as well as to persons, as gaudy furniture, showy dress, a gay parterre. Gay lies at one extreme and is a term of praise. gaudy at the opposite extreme as a term of dispraise, and showy lies between the two.
Oh, I love Smith so much.
Yeah. So that's...
You know, our chat about the thesauruses came, you know, the reason that we first had Hey Roger and all that stuff came out of that sense of being a non-native speaker of English and being absolutely led up the garden path by a thesaurus.
Yeah.
Smith's thesaurus really consciously addresses that.
Yeah, that's what I really about it.
It doesn't just say, here's a list of words, pick one you like. It says, here's a list of words, and here's exactly what they mean and why you should use this one over that one. Mm-hmm. That's, you know, a thesaurus, a modern day, current, continuously updated thesaurus like that, you know, sort of a thesaurus in the mold of tools like the OED Online would be just outstanding.
Yeah, it should be this instead of what we currently have as thesauruses. In order to really help like writers and people, you know, like it's really interesting. But so this,
not just people learning the language, but people learning about, you know, native speakers and non-native speakers.
Yeah, or learning, people just wanting
why
use
that
the
word
language.
Isn't that word?
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah,
use the language better. So, anyway, yeah. So keep those two sort of things in mind, and just the light that the word gay is shone under. This is as late as the late 1800s, right? So,
okay,
this is, you know, life, activity, form, festive arrangement, and light equally contribute to a gay scene. Like, that's a stunning review, as it were.
Yeah, yeah, for sure.
What we have that's entirely missing from any written use so far from 1225 through to 1925 or 1920 is anything to do with homosexuality whatsoever. It
completely
just doesn't exist.
Gone.
Mm. There are no ties anywhere at all. And so
are you telling me that homosexuality was invented in the 1930s, right?
Yeah, that's clearly what I meant, yeah. Otherwise, it would be unremarkable, yeah. So,
and, you know, there is a really brilliant example of the limitations of dictionaries, the limitations of lexicography. Because, you know, if something isn't being written down in a sort of a reasonably legitimate way, it doesn't exist.
Yeah, it's tempting to think that. Yeah, for sure. And in the same way that it's tempting to think that the first OED citation is the first use, and it's easy to fall into
that
pattern.
Yeah, exactly.
So that
sense of there's no mention of that whatsoever. In the same way that in quote unquote polite society, it's not a topic of conversation that would easily come up the way that it could do today.
Right. Now that's obviously not to say that there weren't words, neutral, positive and negative for homosexuality over those centuries. It's just that this particular word exists like 100% siloed off from anything else. And it doesn't actually show up concretely. And it starts in the U.S. In the OED. And the first OED, they've got a couple citations from the 20s and 30s, but they're not explicit. And it's in that gray area where it's starting to be used. And so it says that it could be anachronistically considered to be using the word gay to mean homosexuality when they actually weren't. And so the first direct citation where it's very explicit is from a 1941 academic study called Sex Variance, a Study of Homosexual Patterns. And it identifies the word gay as a sort of endonym that the homosexual community at the time and for the couple decades before that was using for themselves fairly commonly before it became a term more widely used, which didn't happen until basically the 50s. So from the 20s to the 40s in the U.S., that's when it became adopted, and it became adopted very seemingly very consciously by what we now call the gay community, which is kind of interesting because it's in purely a sense of embracing all those positive things about the word itself, right? So that's where it's coming from, and then it gets adopted as a name, an endonym. Mm-hmm. And then it's basically as of sort of the 1980s, there were words, and then in the 50s it became applied to homosexuality, and then between the 50s and the 80s it became so widely used and so strongly associated with homosexuality that there's a 1980 book cited in Edom Online that reports that a word sounding and looking almost exactly like the English word gay was being used in English, French, Dutch, Japanese, Swedish, and Catalan. And so it's really taken off, this thing.
Well, I think that when you have a, I hesitate to use the word scene because, you know, it's society and homosexuality and the history of all that, it's more complex than simply the scene in that scene, particularly when you're talking about a way of life that was criminalized until relatively recently.
Right. And still is in a lot of places.
And in some cases, yes, still is. But it's that whole sense that just because nobody was talking about it, just because nobody was writing about it, doesn't mean it wasn't there. So as soon as we gave it a name that was sort of... as soon as a scene emerged that was able to give itself a name...
Yeah.
Why wouldn't that name go far and, as you say, really take off?
Absolutely, yeah.
It's not just about here is a word for a thing. It's here is a word for a thing that we haven't really had a word for before that we were able to use. So now that we have that, let's use it. Let's use it everywhere we can. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. And it's, yeah, that's perfect, right? Because it's this sort of this, well, you said it perfectly. Yep. There's a great word that they've adopted for them, for that community has adopted for itself, and then it becomes huge because finally there's a thing you can put utterance to, which is,
yeah,
which makes perfect sense. It's only natural. It's Edom Online wraps up its thing, its coverage of the word gay by talking about making a note to being used as a teen slang for bad, undesirable, etc.
Mm-hmm.
A synonym for stupid or useless or whatever. And it says that it's used since 2000, which is interesting because I'm sure that you said that because I can well remember it being teen slang in, I mean, I wasn't a teenager in the late 80s, but I was aware in the late 80s, and I can definitely remember it being used in the late 80s and 90s as a slang to not strictly refer to something. Like, you weren't calling... Nobody was calling the thing they were mad at homosexual, but they were using the word gay in that negative epithet context.
It's an interesting one, isn't it?
I remember going to see well before 2000.
Yeah. I remember going to see the comic Dylan Moran, the guy from... He's in Black Books, the series Black Books. He also appears in films like Shaun of the Dead.
Right.
And he's a great comedian. I really, really like him. But he talked about... the way he described it was... When I say it's gay, I mean it in the strictest playground sense of the word.
Right.
And he was seeking to kind of weed out that sense of when I use that word, I'm being homophobic. And while I absolutely identified with that sense of what he was saying, and you know, have used that word in that sense before, I think it kind of, for me, it became a word to use that I wouldn't use in public, but I would use to somebody I knew who was aware that I wasn't being homophobic.
Right.
You know what I mean? Like, I wouldn't just casually trot that out in a public place or when meeting people I didn't know. I think I'm aware of the fact that it's all very well to say, oh, I didn't mean it like that, when to someone who the word has been applied in perhaps a pejorative sense or a downright insulting and unpleasant sense, I don't know that I get to decide if I mean it like that or not.
Yeah.
Does that make sense?
I mean, the other thing, it was interesting because a while ago, a few months ago now, there are two people I know, one of whom has a developmentally delayed brother.
Mm-hmm.
And one of them, whose brother is gay.
Okay.
And they had this argument between each other because somebody used that the R word, which is used in the same sort of sense as the word gay is to describe something that is undesirable or stupid or silly.
Yeah, sure.
And the person with the developmentally delayed brother got extremely upset by that, even though he uses the word gay in the same way that the other person was using the word retarded. And could not see how they were the same. Could not see how the other, like, because it was such a personal experience for him, and the other was other.
And those things are exactly the same, in my opinion.
100%, right?
Yeah, completely equivalent.
In the same way that if you found out that, oh, that's so Scottish, was just a word that I had grown up using to describe something completely ridiculous and abhorrent.
Yeah, you know, I'd be like, hey, what?
Right?
Well, that's not cool.
Something about your identity is used in a, even if it's not, I'm not saying that thing is actually from Scotland. I'm still just basically taking your nationality and making it a byword for something stupid and unwanted. But yeah. It was just a really stark example of how blind spots work, you know, and how you can be aware of one thing because of your personal experience, but still be completely unable to apply that experience by analogy to another thing. And the other thing that I made that this sort of struck home to me is how many times over the course of these, I guess we're on episode 43 now, of these 43 episodes have we come across in the historical rundowns of words, basically from episode one with nice, where you suddenly see for several decades or even longer, for a century or more, the word takes on this meaning that has nothing to do with the original meaning, but is a pejorative sense of it.
Yeah.
It stays around for
language
a while.
Language is mean.
And then goes away. It's really interesting to be living at what I do actually think is the tail end of that period of several decades where people just decided meanly to use this word and apply it as a pejorative word, divorced from its original meaning. You know what I mean? Like, it's interesting to be in the middle of that.
I feel like, you know, if for example, as a teacher, if I was to walk into a classroom full of teenagers today in 2019, if I was to use that word in that context and say to them, oh no, but I don't mean it like that, they wouldn't think that was cool.
Yeah.
And I feel like, you know, what one of their peers saying that would be called out on that.
Mm-hmm.
That would be recognised rightly as homophobia. Maybe not outright intended homophobia, but nonetheless, you know, language, and we've talked about this before. The language of insult and the language of oppression is incredibly multi-layered and highly dependent on context. But at its root, language that oppresses people isn't okay.
Yeah, exactly.
You know, whether you meant it, whether the context was this, that, or the other, and you know, I'm not the police of the world. I'm not telling people what to say and what not to say. I'm saying what I think about it. And you know, I watched Ali Wong's stand up specials on Netflix over the weekend.
Okay.
I don't know if you know Ali Wong. I found her incredibly hilarious. I watched There's a sort of a Netflix cheesy rom-com affair that she's in and that she wrote called Always Be My Maybe. I watched that because my husband was away and he would never watch a film like that. So right, I watched it by myself. And I liked her so much that I then watched both of her comedy specials, and I was a bit disappointed that there wasn't any more. But she's a really interesting comedian because she is Asian American, and in both of her comedy specials, I think they were filmed like 2 or 3 years apart, in both of them she was heavily pregnant, 7.5 months pregnant.
Oh,
and
wow.
And she is fucking fearless. You know, she says what the hell she wants to say. Like, really brilliantly, wonderfully fearless. I think uncharacteristically so for a lot of female comics. And so she talked about how... Now, let me get this right. She is half Chinese, I think half Filipina, and her husband is half... Sorry, she's half Chinese, half Vietnamese, and her husband is half Filipino, half Japanese. And so she talks about how both of them have, like, high-class Asian and not-so-high-class Asian heritage.
Right.
And so there were a lot of occasions during her stand-up where I had cause to think... No one else could get away with saying what she's saying. But it's hilarious that she's saying it. And the sentiments that she is exposing through her clearly very self-conscious, unique position to say things like this. It's interesting for a lot of different reasons. So what she'd said, for example, she said, I mean, you know, so I'm half Chinese, half Vietnamese. My husband's half Filipino, half Japanese. So while we're at home together and nobody else is around, we just shit on Korean people all the time. You know, and like,
yeah,
that's funny. And it's real. And, yeah, you know, I'm sure that's not the exclusive topic of conversation in their household. But what I mean is, what you say in the privacy of your own home to somebody else who knows what you mean and knows what sort of wavelength you're on and whether or not you intend it to be funny or whether you're being sarcastic or, you know, my husband and I like really, really horribly bad taste jokes.
Right.
And the way that we talk to each other often reflects that. But yeah, that's different to just being a dick to somebody.
Yeah, exactly.
Who you don't know, whose life you're not aware of, whose lifestyle you may inadvertently be judging or condemning. Not okay.
Yeah. Yeah. Not okay.
And that's it for another episode of Lexitecture. To get in touch with us about something you heard in this episode, you can email us at words@lexitecture.com. You can also follow along and talk to us at Lexitecture on Facebook and Twitter, and at Lexitecture Podcast on Instagram. For back episodes and the occasional blog post, visit us at lexitecture.com. Thanks very much, and we'll talk to you again soon. Ha ha ha!